Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I don't have any comments to read today. I have received a few comments, but I needed to think about them a little bit before we read them on the air because people are now asking me questions. So that's really, really good. So after today's program, please send some comments in. Well, with last week's program, we did discuss the espionage taking place while Lawrence was at Carchemish. Now, right after that, we do know that Lawrence had to return to Oxford with his friend Woolley to write the book, which is supposed to prove that their map-making journey for the Palestine Exploration Fund was to discover an Israelite journey in the desert for 40 years under Moses. Now, we know that really wasn't true. But they still had to prove it because, really, things in the world were pretty tense at that time. Now, I think, as you know, that map-making journey was there to provide Britain vital information in preparation for war. Now, when Lawrence got back to Oxford, Korda tells us that the writing was very slow-going. And the reason why the writing was so slow is they had so little to show for their travel. I mean, the one thing, if you know your Bible the way we all should know our Bible, the Israelites did not build cities. So you're not going to find places to excavate. So, the winds of time would have blown all the footprints in the sand much deeper and probably hidden. So essentially, it fell on Lawrence's lap once he got back to Oxford to do a lot of research on, that area. And one thing that also the quarter brings out is Woolley and Lawrence were very different in their styles of writing. So it's hard enough when you get two people that have the same style to write together, and then you get two people that don't have the same style, that would be really hard. Now, one thing I think is interesting is Korda does mention that at this time when Lawrence was in Oxford, that Gertrude Bell, the other famous, let's say, British archaeologist, did visit Lawrence in Oxford. And remember, when they visited Carchemish, it wasn't a very good meeting, but I guess they both threw down the glove. They both got over what their problems were, and they became really good friends. But I do think it's interesting, on page 242, it says that they got together for dinner, and as it says on page 242, they told many hair-raising tales about life in Syria, Mesopotamia, and Arabia. So, I still can't get over the fact that here this young man was walking all around the Middle East, not really caring much about what happened to himself. And, of course, Bell was really, in some ways, the same way. She had that same kind of temperament. But I do think it's interesting that Korda also tells us that Bell had gathered a huge amount of information about the tribes who lived in the desert on either side of the Hejaz Railway, including the Hawatat. And this information would be absolutely invaluable for Lawrence when he became Lawrence of Arabia. And so again, I still want to come back to my point that I really believe that Lawrence was prepared and, for what he was going to be doing, certainly later in the war. Now, for today's program, what I want to do is I want to begin our discussion of the very next chapter in Korda's book. And really, it's the next chapter in Lawrence's life as well. And the title of that chapter is Cairo, 1914 to 1916. Now, what's interesting is I think Korda gives us a great introduction to this chapter, again on page 242, and it's about how World War I actually got started. And I think it's really important for your listeners to really understand that this is incredible history, and it's probably history that a lot of people either don't know or they've forgotten. And he goes on to say, he says, there is no evidence, despite their political sophistication, that they dwelt on the news that the heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and his wife had been assassinated by Serb nationalists at Sarajevo on June 28, 1914. On July 28, an even more sinister event took place. Unsatisfied by the Serbians' reply to its ultimatum, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia, and in response, Serbia's patron, Russia, began the slow, by reason of its immense size and primitive road and rail system, process of mobilizing its army, the largest in the world. Alarmed, Germany declared war on Russia on August 2nd. On August 3rd, France, obliged by treaty to mobilize its army in support of Russia, found itself at war with Germany. In accordance with the long-standing plans of the German High Command, the German army invaded neutral Belgium as to reach Paris by the shortest possible route. Standing in his office as the long summer day drove to a close, Sir Edward Grey, the British Foreign Secretary, said, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. I fear we will not see them lit again in our lifetime." The next day, August 4th, obligated by a 75-year-old treaty to defend Belgium's neutrality, a horrified and divided liberal government declared war on Germany. So that's the beginning of this chapter. Now, to help me discuss this chapter, with me today in the studio is James Brandon. Welcome back, James.
Good to be here.
So let's start talking about this Cairo chapter. What are your thoughts on it as we get started here?
Oh, I mean, it's a fascinating piece of history because you're really talking about a war that a lot of people have kind of forgotten about, at least the details of it, but also a theater of that war that was really vital and impacts history to this very day. But again, that theater of war was the lesser known at the time. We generally think of World War I and we think of what went on in Europe, but some really important stuff happened in the Middle East, and Lawrence was right in the thick of all that. And so was Winston Churchill, as we'll talk about later. It's just a really fascinating little piece of history that this chapter covers.
Yeah, I think the Lawrence statement there, it's almost poetic how he introduces the chapter. And it just seemed like everybody got sucked into it. It's not that they really wanted to. It's like they had to.
It was all these old treaties and these old agreements that, you know, they were all kind of dragged in. It was a domino effect, really. It's that started with Serbia and Austro-Hungary, but by the end, you've got most of Europe dragged into that,
yes.
And Russia, and then the Middle East.
Yeah, yeah. But even England wasn't necessarily ready for it. And I think it's interesting, at the very beginning of the chapter, Korda talks about the Lawrence family and how, the one brother who was still in India, he wanted to get into the war, and the other brothers wanted to get into the war. And the one brother, Will, thought that the war would only last for about 1 week because the British Navy was so good.
Yeah, for some reason he thought that World War I was going to be fought on the seas.
Right.
I'm not sure where he got that idea, but no. Lawrence dissuaded him of that.
Yeah, Lawrence got to that right away. But anyway, it's interesting that it seems like his brothers were able to get into the war really quickly, but Lawrence wasn't able to do that. In fact, he was sidelined from it for a while. So let's talk about that for a while. I think one of the things that Korda brings out that Lawrence had no desire to become a subaltern.
Yeah, he didn't want to. He was not interested in being below people.
No.
He thought he was smarter than just about everybody he met.
Yeah. Yeah, if he couldn't be a captain,
he
didn't want to be a part of it.
I mean, it was hard enough for him to respect the men in the high-up positions. He had issues with authority with anybody that it didn't matter how high up they were in the military hierarchy. If he didn't think that, you know, if he didn't share the same ideas as them, he really did look down on people. He thought that his ideas were pretty well-developed and wasn't really interested in hearing what other people had to say on a lot of things.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I think the other thing that's really funny is that he didn't meet the height requirements.
He was too short.
He was 5 feet 5 inches, and he was known as the gnome.
He was a petite man.
Yeah, or diminutive. Yes. I think they also use that word, diminutive. So he didn't have a chance. Also, we do know, Korda just told us, the Liberal government was really unsure about going to war. So it is amazing what I think what they bring up here in this chapter is. Now, we know that indirectly, Lawrence was under Earl Kitchener, mm-hmm. you know, during this war. But also, I think it's interesting that Korda brings out Winston Churchill's views of the war and Kitchener's view of the war, and they were kind of like opposite each other. And so,
but they had to work together.
Yeah.
I mean, with Kitchener being over the War Office, and he was over the land army, I suppose, and then Churchill was over the Navy. Navy.
Yeah.
So you had these two main branches of the army that need to work together in close concert, but two men with very different approaches, not just to war making and strategy, but two different approaches to dealing with their people as well, right. Managerial styles.
Well, I just think it's interesting. Here we have talked so much about Winston Churchill in the past, and certainly, you know, the problem he had with the Dardanelles. And the thing is, it was this tug of war between the way he wanted to run the Navy and by the way Kitchener wanted to run the Army. That's what caused the problems. They did not agree. And look what happened. There was a major loss of life, major loss of a battle that really should have been won.
Yeah, and that lack of willingness to just go to war and get a thing done. You talked about the Liberal government being divided about going to war, and the nation itself pretty unsure about going to war, leadership not really being fully committed. And that's so much of that disastrous Dardanelles and Gallipoli campaign came down to leadership that was there was one, I forget his name at the moment, but it's there in the book, but the original captain that was over the Navy that was running up the Dardanelles, he had to be replaced at the last minute because he had a panic attack or something, right. And they had someone else that had to step in, and then he thought they were sustaining too heavy losses, and so he made the executive decision to turn around and stop the campaign, which left all those Anzac soldiers stranded.
They became captives.
Yep.
Yes. So anyway, but Churchill was a go-getter. He said, if we're going to go, we're going to win. And, you know, but Kitchener, he took it a little bit, he was not a politician. He also, you know, did not like political, the infighting and the give and take, or, you know, but Churchill was just matched for all that.
Yeah.
So I think Churchill could argue his way out of a lot of things.
Churchill is much more of a politician than Kitchener.
Yeah.
Kitchener just wanted to deal with the military and not worry about the political side of it. But unfortunately, with the way our governments are structured today, there's no way to extricate those two from each other.
No. But I do think it's also good that Korda brings out that the other thing that held Lawrence back from getting in the war is Kitchener wanted that Wilderness of Zindun.
The book. The fake book. Is a real book, I suppose, but yeah. It was their excuse to spy on the Sinai Peninsula.
Yeah, President Trump would like that, the fake book. And it is interesting that this book, it comes back to haunt Lawrence in several different ways before we get out of this chapter. So one of the things I think is really funny is, you know, the way Lawrence, you know, as you said, he had very little respect for those over him. And yet he was such a genius and so smart, and he was so talented that they had to deal with him.
I think the men that he did wind up getting along with, because it wasn't that he rubbed everybody the wrong way. Some people did get along with him. But I think the ones that really respected the rigidity and structure of the military classes and the officer ranks, and it sort of expected to be treated a certain way because of where they were ranked, Lawrence rubbed them completely the wrong way, because he had no regard for that at all. All he cared about was your ideas and your intellect. He didn't care what stripes you had on your sleeve or anything like that. And so he did rub people the wrong way, because the British military is very much all about tradition and rank and structure and respecting your superiors.
Almost to a fault.
Yeah, and Lawrence, I think, exposed some of the hypocrisy in that, and he felt that he was as smart, if not smarter, than many of the men that held esteemed positions.
And I do think that some of the things with Ned is that he was pretty much bothered that his father had given up his baron, his status of being a baron, and the sons of barons generally were put in high positions right away.
He could have moved up the ranks a lot faster. He got to where he got in a very unorthodox way, but
yeah, we'll talk about that.
I wonder if he just felt like his life could have been a lot different, and he could have gotten where he wanted to get a lot faster,
right,
if it weren't for what his father had done.
Right. I think it's human nature, you know, that if you know, if you can't get what you want, it's easier to see the faults in other people.
Blame someone else.
Yeah. So I think he had a lot of blame. But again, you can see that even in the long run, sometimes you do have to be as tough as Churchill to get things done. You
know? Oh, yeah. There's similarities if you read any of My Early Life by Churchill or any of his experiences about in the Boer War and the way that he exposed himself to different things. And there's a lot of similarities there between the way Churchill sort of went out and just did everything, and the way that Lawrence did as well.
Yeah, they were out of the same mold. They really believed in empire. Well, I guess I shouldn't say. I don't think Lawrence believed in empire like
not to the same way that Churchill did.
Right, but Lawrence definitely believed in being a hero.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, so he got that much out of the empire. All right, so let's just go on now. And since we're talking about Churchill, I think it's kind of fascinating that Korda does bring out. This whole thing that's going on with Turkey, and that, again, for those that are listening, I think you really need to study this chapter. If you really want to understand what's going on in the world today, it's almost being repeated, you know, specifically. But, Winston Churchill also got in the middle of this whole thing because Turkey was playing both sides of the fence. They wanted German support, but they also wanted British support. But it turns out the British were playing both sides of the fence as well. They weren't sure of what Turkey was going to do, and so they were still trying to kind of cozy up to them, and they weren't really sure what Germany was going to do. But there were some people in the military in Britain that really wanted to kind of bring the Turkish Empire down so they could have more control in the Middle East. And so those thoughts were in Kitchener's mind, even though he may not have been the best politician or maybe he wasn't the best debater, is he really did believe that the success of the British Empire was going to depend on the Arabs revolting against the Turks or the Turkish Empire.
Even from a industry and manufacturing standpoint, leaving aside the politics and the military, this was right around the time when Britain was beginning to transition out of coal as its primary fuel source and move into petroleum products to power everything. And this was right around that time, and they knew that what was called Mesopotamia back then, that we'd think of today as Iran and Iraq, was rich.
Very,
with that resource.
Right.
And so that was a deal breaker for them in many respects when we'll talk about some of the deals that they cut. They wanted control in that area.
And I still think they're playing with Iran and Iraq today for the same reason.
They've been in Afghanistan for a couple hundred years now in various forms or fashion, but just always been involved in the Middle East.
Right. And so there's, you know, the United States can stand up and say, we're not going to be a part of the Iranian nuclear deal and everyone hates us. But, you know, we do have a good supply of oil.
Yep.
You know, and they don't. So I do think it's interesting, where Winston Churchill stopped the Turkish purchase of the warships. And then that just totally, you know, sent things spinning.
It was a real it was politically bad on both sides because it was hard for both leaders to spin that to their people. I believe the term, I think Korda put it in quotation marks, he requisitioned those warships. So in name, he sort of took something. It wasn't that he stole them, at least on paper. He requisitioned them from an ally, but they were Turkish warships, and they didn't know what Turkey was going to do with them, and so Churchill figured it was safer to offend the Turks than let them have these two battleships.
Yes. The Turkish had paid for them, though.
They had already paid. Well, they'd crowdsourced the funding for it.
Right.
They'd asked for donations. It was a national support thing. They offered medals of patriotism to people that made sizable donations to pay for these warships. And then England just swooped in there, or Churchill swooped in there and said, we're going to take these. So
right.
It did not make England popular in Turkey at a time when they needed to be.
And then the Germans took full advantage of the situation. And
oh, yeah. They saw an opening for a real political propaganda play. They swept in there with two of their new cruisers that they'd just built and a full complement of crew for each of them. And they sailed in there to Istanbul, and the officers all changed into Turkish uniforms and fezes. And they said, we're part of your army now.
Right. Until towards the end, then they...
Yeah.
The Germans were really working to kind of force Turkey into the war on their side. The Germans wanted Turkey on their side.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, why do you think they wanted Turkey on their side? Because they still wanted access to Mideast oil. You know, there was the Suez Canal. They wanted to control the Suez Canal as well. So I think all of our listeners out there have to see these are the same kind of things we're building in the Middle East right now. The Suez Canal comes up every now and then. Who's going to control that? We know Iran. They want control of that area. They want to be able to control the flow of oil to both Europe and if the United States needs it. You know, they want to control all that. So, but I think Winston Churchill had he really had the right idea, and I think he was right because you know, it turns out then that Germany went in, and then the Rear Admiral, I forget his name, was Souchon or something.
Souchon, I think.
Yeah. He sounds French, but I think it's German. But, you know, there's that part of Germany and France where they're together anyway. So,
yeah.
But he goes in there, gets through the Dardanelles, gets up into the Black Sea, and then starts the war against Russia.
Really, yeah. and pulls Turkey in. Without any consent from Turkey, he kind of tricked them.
Yeah. And so everything got started. Just like Korda said, everyone gets dragged in. And once the one domino falls, then they all fall.
Oh, yeah.
And then here we have World War One beginning. But I think it's funny that Winston Churchill, it's like, I'm not sure how to say the name of the one Turkish official. It's a Rashadi, I guess, or Rashadi. And a second one was Sultan Osman I. And then when Churchill took over, like, Vola, one becomes the HMS Arran, and the other one becomes the HMS Agincourt.
Completely British.
Completely British. And, of course, those who know Shakespeare, you know, Agincourt is one of the favorite names that I like because of Henry V and the Battle of Agincourt.
Yes.
So Churchill knew his Shakespeare.
They would have had to refit one of those battleships, I just realized, because the Turkish had built it with their with their Turkish squat toilets.
Squat
in
toilets.
In the head. I don't think the British soldiers would have been too thrilled with that.
No.
So I'm sure they did some refurbishing before they were fully committed to the British Navy.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, yeah, I know I had my experience one time. I flew through Japan. And I had a five-hour layover in Japan, and I did not know how to use Japanese toilets.
So they're like robots from what I've heard.
Yeah. It's just you can't believe. It's like, okay, how do you manage this one? So eventually I was able to go to the American side of the airport, and I was happy. So anyway, well, let's talk briefly. We're going to run out of time here pretty quick. But let's talk just briefly about how Lawrence finally did get assigned to Cairo.
Yeah, it's a pretty fascinating little chain of events there.
Because
he's currently, I guess, ostensibly creating this book for Kitchener on the wilderness of Zin, on their travels in the Sinai. So
he actually got it done.
He did get it done. And then he had to do it again. But
yeah.
we'll probably wind up talking about that later.
So, but eventually, it's Hogarth, and it's Woolley, and it's the really good friends that get him assigned to Cairo, because at Cairo they realize they need to have maps made.
Right.
And so now I'm going to have to make this big announcement. Well, sorry, we're out of time for today's program. So next time we'll continue our discussion of Lawrence at Cairo. Now remember, for this current series of programs, we are using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can still buy this book at Amazon.com, or you can find a copy at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. And there's still a lot of time for you to get the book and read it. If you're just catching up with us now, that's okay. Please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. Streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.